be a symposium entitled QTL That Matter, and that will start at 2:30. At this point, I would like to go ahead and commence with the Calvin Sperley Biodiversity Memorial Lectureship. This lectureship was formed in 1998 in honor of Calvin Sperley, who is lost to us at an exceptionally early age, but was an economic botanist with USDA ARS at Beltsville of considerable repute and accomplishment. He was particularly well known for his enthusiasm and consistent excellence in field research, as well as extensive work to conserve biological biodiversity, all of this being a part of overall efforts to improve crop plants worldwide. The lectureship is intended to recognize outstanding contributions of scientists in the field of plant genetic resources. As you can imagine, this is annually a very difficult choice to select individuals, so I'd like to acknowledge the committee that has participated in this. Those of you who were here last year will recall that I was here, and normally the chairperson for this rotates every year, but due to this various circumstances, I served a second year, for better or for worse, but I was accompanied by a lot of people with considerable expertise, including Charles Brummer, David Bubeck, Ambika Chandra, Byron Burson, Patricia Jusku, and Andrea Cardinale. And I'd like to thank them for helping with this process of choosing our speaker. So our lecturer this year is Michael Kassler, standing to my right. I've known Michael for over 30 years, in as much as I was at Wisconsin when he arrived there. So Michael is now a research geneticist with the USDA Dairy Forage Research Center in Madison, Wisconsin. He is also a professor of agronomy at the University of Wisconsin. His formal education included a BS degree from the University of Illinois, as well as master's and PhDs from the University of Minnesota. So Mike's research has a focus that brings into play breeding, genetics, and genomics of perennial grasses for both pasture and or biomass production. He is responsible for developing meadow fescue as a new and viable pasture species for North America, as well as for increasing the biomass yield potential and adaptation range of switchgrass. He is the author of 221 refereed journal articles, 437 other publications, and I'm sure that's a little bit fluid because those things can change quickly. But anyway, Mike is also a very accomplished teacher. In addition to being an accomplished researcher, he has taught advanced statistical data analysis and experimental design for 35 years at the UW and at workshops at various venues. He's published numerous journal articles and chapters on advanced methods of statistical analysis of agronomic data. And today, Mike's going to talk to us about his topic. It's just grass, isn't it?
Okay, thanks very much, David. And I'd like to thank my good friend Charlie for nominating me for this. And I'd also like to thank the rest of the committee for choosing me. This is quite an honor to be here. First of all, the title. Where does that title come from? Those of you that know me really well, no surprise. Those of you that don't know me, I had an intern in my lab this summer. I've had many interns over the years, but this one was very unique. She's a high school teacher in northern Wisconsin, and she decided she wanted to incorporate switchgrass breeding, genetics, and genomics into her senior biology class in high school. So she spent 2 months in my lab this summer learning all those things, and at the end of that two-month period, she said to me, I can't believe all that I've learned this summer. She said, you taught me so many things. I always thought grass was just either turf grass or tall grass. So that's where my title comes from. The other thing about this slide, you see there's a picture of me there. And that also tells a small story about me. Again, those of you that know me really well, there's no surprise here. Those of you that don't know me, I'm like a lot of you. My mind is always working. It doesn't matter where in the world I am or what I'm doing. I'm always working. This picture was taken by my wife while we were on vacation. We were wandering around northern Wisconsin, hiking various places, and we stumbled across this prairie savanna site that had switchgrass growing in it. And, you know, I got really excited. I'm wandering around. We're looking at the switchgrass. My wife is tolerating me just fine. And I see that there's something actually very, there's two distinct types of switchgrass here. And just to make a long story short, and this isn't really the story for today, but that turned out to be one of two sites in North America where we've actually discovered evidence and we've actually been able to document gene flow between the tetraploid and the octoploid level. We found this while we were on vacation. So, anyway, okay, that's part of my story. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to tell you three stories. Each story is going to be a little bit longer than that one. And my three stories are all three that are very near and dear to me, and they're all germplasm stories, so they fit the theme of the biodiversity lecture. I'm going to talk about kith and kin. I'm going to talk about the grass may very well be greener on the other side of the hill, and which some of you may recognize as a sort of a slight change to some Grateful Dead lyrics. And then my last story is going to be better late than never, which really should be better never than late. So, of kith and kin. The story starts in 1988 when I received a phone call asking me if I would get involved in conducting on-farm research under management intensive grazing, which was kind of a strange idea to me, but I thought, okay, why not? You know, I was open-minded. So, after 5 years of doing this on-farm research, I had agreed to work with these folks, and after about 5 years, I became sold, and I started converting my breeding program, both objectives and species, towards solving some of the grass production problems that these grazers were facing. So as a result of this, I ended up spending a lot of time thinking about this because it really changes the way you're thinking about breeding when you move from a conservation system to a grazing system. You've got livestock, and you've got all kinds of other stresses. So I spent a lot of time thinking about how to select the best grasses that would be tolerant of grazing stress and productive under a range of grazing managements. And that led into the next story. And this is my connection, surprisingly, to Calvin Sperling. When I did a little bit of research on Calvin's background, I discovered that my grandparents, Halvor and Amanda Bourne, are buried 40 miles away from Calvin Sperling's hometown of Farwell, Minnesota. Small world, isn't it? So anyway, so here I am, 1996 in western Minnesota. We had just had a big family reunion, about 150 people in my mom's side of the family. And after the family reunion, a small number of us went to visit my grandparents' gravesite. First time I'd ever been there. And so I'm paying my respects. But after, we'd been there for a couple of minutes, you can probably guess where my mind is. My mind is on the grass. And I'm looking at this grass, and I can see there's two kinds of grass there. One of them is your standard Kentucky bluegrass that you'd see in a cemetery, and the other is that little kind of wispy, tall-growing grass that's sticking up above it about 6 inches tall, and that's smooth-grown grass. That's something that I've worked on for many, many years. And so here I am. I get in the car. I got a 7-hour drive home, and after about 4 hours, my wife looks at me, and she says, "What in the world are you thinking about?" She could see I was so focused. I was already planning research several years down the road based on what I had seen right here. And so what we did is we went back to this cemetery and we ended up going to many other cemeteries. We were very interested in the idea that this grass growing in the cemetery where it's constantly managed, constantly mown, might have some grazing tolerance. And what we did is we went to these places and every one of these cemeteries that we chose had an internal control. There's a fence population shown here on the right, and then here's the bone grass growing in the sod. And so we visited 111 cemeteries over the next 2 or 3 years. We collected from 30 of these cemeteries that met our requirements. We collected both fence and sod populations, again, the fence being the control, and we collected about 50 to 60 isolated tiller samples per population. And then we did all kinds of experiments, simple experiments like agronomic performance experiments where we evaluated these populations at 2 cuts per year, 3 cuts per year, and 4 cuts per year, Just very simple, just to get an idea of whether they're adapted to more frequent cutting. And the results were actually pretty disappointing. It's one of those things that seemed like a really good idea, but we weren't sure it was going to work out. The fence population was higher in yield than the sod population, regardless of how they were managed. We were hoping we'd get better regrowth potential down here from the sod population, but you can see it didn't really work out that way, at least averaged over all the cemeteries. But we did have two sites that actually looked pretty good, that actually met our criteria. So here we have site 10 on the left, we have site 11 on the right here, and interestingly enough, just to make the family connection again, site 10 is where my wife's parents are buried. So just again, another family connection just keeps happening. So this is forage yield under two cuts. The fence population is higher in yield under three cuts as well, but then they converge together, which is actually sort of what we're looking for. And then if you look down here under regrowth potential, for regrowth percentage, you can see there's much higher regrowth percentage in the sod population, and that's one of the things that we're looking for to give us grazing tolerance. We want more regrowth, we want better regrowth in these populations, and so this is actually kind of encouraging. So these two sites actually look pretty good. So then we started thinking a little bit about this and wondering about genetic mechanisms so on. This was just about the time we got started in our lab doing DNA markers. And so we did some DNA marker work. Here on the left are the original plants from those two cemeteries. And this is a PCA plot, so it's just a way of taking the DNA markers and putting them in two dimensions. And you can see there's a little bit of separation here. Between the two. It's not strong separation, but a little bit to indicate that there's some difference. But then what we did is for the next experiment is we took these samples here, these plants from the fence, and we subjected them, these are from the sod, we subjected them to 3 years of frequent mowing, and then we took these plants from the fence and subjected them to 3 years of cutting twice per year. So in other words, we continued these plants and their progeny on to the next generation with the similar management to what they under which they had evolved. And then we really started to get some very, very strong separation. And you can see that here in the DNA marker analysis of the next group of the progeny population, where we got very, very strong separation. So that was really interesting because it gave me some evidence and some indication that we're talking about the possibility of natural selection. Well, this was about the time that other things were happening, and you might look at this and you might say, wow, there's some potential here, but this is actually where the project stops, okay? And so it stops, and I take you to lessons and conclusions at this point, and this leads to one of the conclusions, of course. So one of my conclusions, obviously, family reunions can surprise you. You never know what might happen or what might come from attending. And yes, you can write manuscripts and plan research in your head while you're driving, even if you're on vacation, without upsetting your spouse. But, as all of you know, time and funding are always a limitation, and they really did not allow us to come up with a definitive conclusion as to whether or not this project was a great idea. Sometimes projects get cut short for reasons that have nothing to do with the science or impact, and this project got cut short by this project. By the whole idea that the grass may very well be greener on the other side of the hill. So this story is all about the oak savanna ecosystem and what it's become. So those of you that don't know, the oak savanna was an intermediate ecosystem between the tall grass prairie and the eastern deciduous forest. And so it's shown here by the kind of the orange area here. It's intermittent oak savanna between those two ecosystems. And the study area that we're interested in is what's called the driftless area. And so it's kind of an oval area right here, encompasses four states in the upper Mississippi River area. It's unglaciated, it's very hilly, very shallow prairie soils. It was farmed for grain crops from the late 1940s through the 1970s. Starting in the 1980s, there's a movement toward grazing, and a lot of people stopped farming it, and they let it go back to nature, so to speak, which meant grass-based production systems. But many oak groves, many of the bur oak groves that that were part of that oak savanna survived that entire time because they were areas that just couldn't be farmed very well. So this is just a series of four pictures just to give you a little bit of an idea of what some of these ecosystems look like. These are four different snapshots from different areas in the Driftless region to show you what this oak savanna looked like. And so this is one of those remnants of the oak savanna, the Charles Opitz farm. One morning, Charles Opitz called me, and he used to like to call me about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I would always know when the phone rings at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's one of two people. It's either Charlie Opitz wants to talk, usually that lasts for about an hour or so, we talk about grass and other things, or it's my wife with a problem. But so I always know to answer the phone when it rings at 6 o'clock in the morning. And one day it was Charlie. He says, "I've got a grass on my farm that I can't identify." So my ears perked up. This sounded really interesting. So I go out there, and we find this unknown grass. It's got leaf and stem morphology of ryegrass, but it's got a fescue panicle. So I'm like, wow, this is really unusual. So we did a little bit of work, and I had a lot of people helping me try to figure it out. We finally figured out what it was. But in the meantime, he didn't care what it was. And so 10 years later, I'm going to get back to the story of what it was in just a second. But 10 years later, he called me again, and he says, "You know, I really think you need to come out to my farm again." I said, "Okay, great." So he said, "But you need to spend a day." All right, so I go out there for a day. We get into his ATV, and we're driving all the way around the farm. And half the day later, we've driven around the entire farm, 2,000 acres, and I had seen this grass on the entire farm, whereas just 10 years earlier, it was only on this one hilltop. So now it's on 2,000 acres. And after a half a day of this, he looked at me and goes, "Have I got your attention now?" I said, "Yeah, you've got my attention. How in the world did you do this?" And this is how he did it. What he did is he would let the crop ripen here in the upper left, let the seed crop ripen. He'd take those bales of hay, he'd feed them out on pasture during the winter and feed them through his cows. And, of course, you've all heard the phrase, I don't know where it comes from, I couldn't find it, history moves on the hooves of cows. Basically, those cows established that grass on those 2,000 acres. It took him 10 years to do it, but that's how he got it on the entire farm. So, come back to the story. What is this grass? Well, we kind of narrowed it down. It was either a fescue or a ryegrass based on the morphology. So we took the four most likely candidates, tall fescue, meadow fescue, perennial ryegrass, and annual ryegrass. We did DNA markers. And you can see the cluster diagram shows that all the unknown samples cluster with what the samples that we call FP, which is Festuca pratensis, and that's meadow fescue. And this just totally threw us for a loop because, you know, a meadow fescue wasn't on our radar screen. We didn't know anything about it. Nobody knew anything about it. Nobody grows meadow fescue in the United States. And so we were just very, very surprised. So we got started. And we went out, we did a lot of field sampling, and we ended up sampling about 95 farms over the next couple of summers, a number of sites per farm, a number of plants per site. It's a very, very intensive study. This gives you a little bit of an idea. This is that four-state region that I showed you, the Driftless area. It gives you a little bit of an idea of the number of pastures we found with what we feel is meadow fescue. Some of them are confirmed with DNA markers. Others are just confirmed with either morphology or just based on visual. Most of them are in Wisconsin, but there are some in the other states as well. And you can see they tend to cluster in an area, and where they cluster is on near what's called the old Military Ridge Road. And this is the old area of settlements when Wisconsin was first settled by Europeans in the 1850s. It was before about the 1830s and 1840s. Wisconsin was first settled by miners, and we had the military was there, and it was all along the Military Ridge Road, and that's where we see the most concentration of this. So where does it come from? Well, meadow fescue is European, all right. So if you go back to the European literature, there are three centers of origin of meadow fescue. For the post-glacial expansion of meadow fescue, there's an Iberian population, there's a Transylvanian population, and there's a Caucasian population. All three of those are represented in Wisconsin, in the Driftless area. And also, we found a fourth one that the Europeans, that isn't in the European database, so we don't actually know where that comes from. basically what it indicates is that this isn't just one introduction event and the neighbors shared it among themselves. It's at least four separate introduction events that led to Meadow Fescue coming in. And that kind of makes sense because Wisconsin was a melting pot in those days. There were Germans and Swedes and Norwegians and Italians and people from all over Europe coming in to these mining and agricultural areas. So it's pretty diverse. And then as we think about how it got there, we don't really have the answers to that, but we do have a little bit of information. So one of the things we did is we started thinking about Meadow Fescue. So we went way back in USDA seed production literature, and we dug out all this data on seed production of fescue. And you can see that there was Meadow Fescue seed production in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. It's this line down here, way down on the bottom of this graph. And it's way down on the bottom because the graph has to be large enough to accommodate the introduction of tall fescue when the variety Kentucky 31 was released. Kentucky 31 was released right about here, and that's when tall fescue seed production shot up, and basically Meadow Fescue disappeared. It disappeared from the scene because it wasn't as high yielding, so people weren't interested in growing it, and it just went off, totally off our radar screen. By the time I was an undergrad at the University of Illinois and studying forages, the textbooks never even mentioned Meadow Fescue at all. So how did it get to the driftless area? We don't really know. Was it European immigrants? Did they bring the seed directly from Europe by primary immigration, or was it secondary immigration? Did they come into the eastern U.S. and then move to Wisconsin? Or did they come in here to this area, which we now know as the Fescue Belt, where they used to grow Meadow Fescue? And a lot of the old-timers in the driftless area tell me that what happened is they used to graze cattle there during the winter, and then those cattle would be loaded onto railroad cars and shipped up to the driftless area for the summer grazing. And so did it come in their guts? We don't know the answer to that. Could be a combination of all of those things. So, Meadow Fescue has an endophyte. A lot of you are thinking about endophytes, probably, those of you that work on forages. An endophyte is a fungus that lives inside the plant. It forms a mutualistic relationship with the plant. The host provides water, nutrients, and structure. The fungus provides anti-herbivory and environmental tolerances. Meadow fescue has an endophyte, just like the other fescues. The most common one is Epicloa uncinata, but we also have Bromicola typhina and Festusae. The meadow fescue endophytes, interestingly enough, are benign to livestock. They don't produce what's called ergovaline alkaloids, which are the ones that are toxic to livestock. And we've been asked the question many times, what about the endophyte? What's the status here? So we've started to do some sampling. We've sampled over 3,000 plants from 28 farms, at least 100 plants per farm, and we found an 80% infection rate based on a combination of a positive PCR and a positive ELISA test. And so far, what we've discovered is we've discovered three different genotypes of the endophyte. Now, we don't know yet whether those three genotypes are three different genotypes of Epicloa uncinata or whether they actually represent different species. We aren't quite that sophisticated yet. We're still learning some of the technology here. But one of the questions we have is whether or not there's a fitness advantage associated with the endophyte. So we're actually doing experiments right now to figure that out. We don't really have much of an idea on the answer to that yet. We could guess, but I'm not willing to stick my neck out at that. But what's really exciting about this is agronomic performance. And Jeff Brink is the one that's done all of this work. My colleague Jeff Brink just down the hall from me at the Dairy Forage Center. So he's done all these agronomic experiments to compare meadow fescue to tall fescue and orchard grass, shown here in the blue highlight. These are our controls, and this is forage yield. Here we've got some European meadow fescues that are in these experiments. We have what's called Hidden Valley meadow fescue, which is the original meadow fescue that came from the Opitz farm, the first one where it was discovered. And then we have a couple of other meadow fescues here, Azov, and an experimental fescue that doesn't have a name yet. These were both bred for higher yield in my breeding program since we started working on this. And you can see that, we've got Wisconsin and New York in the four columns, HZ4 and HZ3, those are the USDA hardiness zones. So the higher the number represents a warmer climate, southern Wisconsin. HZ3 is northern Wisconsin. And then in New York, we have southern New York and northern New York. And what's interesting is that we have a severe yield penalty in the warmer climate. Wisconsin and southern New York, we lose about 10% yield compared to the Czechs. But as you go into northern, central and northern Wisconsin, and the same thing for northern New York, we make up almost all of that yield penalty, and the meadow fescues actually have pretty good yield, especially those that have been bred for higher yield. So that's encouraging. But what's most encouraging and what's most significant about this is the forage quality. This is neutral detergent fiber digestibility, or the digestibility of the fiber fraction. And there are four varieties plotted across here under a frequent harvest management, and this would be six cuts per year, and under an infrequent management, three cuts per year. And you can see it doesn't matter what the management is, it doesn't matter what the location is, it doesn't matter what year it is. We're always about 5 percentage units higher in NDF digestibility, which is actually very, very exciting from the standpoint of developing a new forage crop. So I've had a lot of collaborators on this project in trying to help figure out exactly what it is, helping us get up to speed in some of the technologies of using DNA markers, and a lot of people have been involved in getting us to this point. And this brings us to the end of the second story. My lessons and conclusions from the meadow fescue story are never, ever underestimate the value of participatory research, especially when it comes to using actual working farms as selection and or evaluation environments. The only forage germplasm of any commercial value that's ever come out of my research program has been developed in partnership with farmers and farmer advisors. And so I just say to you, especially you young people, be open-minded to new ideas that are not your own, because sometimes change can be a very good thing. All right, and that brings us to my last story. My last story, as I said, is better late than never. But really, it should be titled Better Never Than Late. And this is a story about flowering. And it's flowering in switchgrass. So this is the biomass crop. My breeding program on switchgrass is very easy. I only have one goal. My goal is to get to 10 tons per acre. That's the magic number. That's what all the economists say we need to do to make switchgrass as a biomass crop economically viable. And so I only have one goal. Yeah, there's a lot of other little things, disease resistance and persistence and all these other things that are components of yield, but you know, they're just components of yield, and I'll use them as we need to, but I really only have just the one goal, and that's to get to 10 tons per acre. So, whoops, going the wrong way. Okay, so those of you that don't know switchgrass very well, this is a map of switchgrass adaptation prior to European settlement of North America, when we started busting up the prairie and busting up the oak savanna. You can see it was very, very broadly adapted in terms of geography, climate, and habitats. No one genotype is broadly adapted on this entire map, but the species itself is. And you can see it goes all the way down to the Mexico, to Mexico, as well as some of the Caribbean countries. But switchgrass is ruled by adaptation zones. And adaptation zones are defined by temperature, but they also differ in photoperiod. And temperature and photoperiod are the two environmental factors that really rule what we see in terms of phenotypic and genotypic variation in this particular species. And you're going to see that this is going to come up over and over again in our breeding program. So the first way they come up is there's two ecotypes of switchgrass. What we call the upland ecotype and the lowland ecotype. The upland ecotype is adapted to northern latitudes. Upland soils tend to be drier soils. It's very short and fine, thin stems, early flowering, and a classic green color. Whereas the lowland ecotype is more adapted to the southern latitudes and tends to be more adapted to low-lying areas, hence comes the name. It's tall and coarse, it has very thick stems, it's very late flowering, and it tends to have a bluish tint. This is the classic lowland phenotype, the single plant growing in this nursery, surrounded by upland ecotypes. You can see the upland plants on both sides of it. Well, especially the one here on the left is already in seed production, whereas this lowland plant is just barely starting to produce panicles. They're just out of the boot right there. So this is in southern Wisconsin, and usually we see between a 4 and 6 weeks difference in flowering time between the upland and lowland type. So it's a very, very significant difference. And here's the importance of this trait to us from a biomass production standpoint. So the graph on the top is using local or traditional varieties that flower in early August They reach peak biomass right at the time of flowering, and we're losing about 6 to 8 weeks of growing season. I mean losing 6 to 8 weeks of growing season. There's no more growth. That crop is focused on only one thing, and that's producing seed to advance to the next generation. This is still a wild species, okay? It's not been domesticated. And so senescence occurs long before killing frost. And all we're trying to do is we're trying to take these plants or find plants that are later in flowering, and we want to get them to flower right up against killing frost. And that's where my alteration of the title comes, is better never than late. Because ultimately, my goal in the breeding program is I don't want them to flower at all. I'd like to get to a point where I get killing frost and there's not even any evidence of flowering yet. I don't know that I'll get there. I'm 62 years old, so probably I won't get there, but that's my goal. Okay? But you can see the concept. What we're trying to do is we're trying to keep that biomass curve going up all the way to killing frost. And so our strategy here initially was very simple. We would grow upland and lowland types, and we were initially just growing variety trials. We were doing variety evaluation, looking at populations, and what we would typically see is you can see here is an upland variety, very well adapted. Here's another upland variety on the right-hand side, very well adapted. And here's a lowland variety planted in a plot. This plot is about 15 square feet, just to give you some perspective. Actually, it's a little bit, it's probably more like about 25 or 30 square feet. And out of that 25 or 30 square feet, we would have put about 1,000 seeds in the ground, and you can see there's about 3 plants left alive after the first winter. So, you know, your initial reaction when you're doing variety trials is you're like, oh, man, you know, I'm not going to get any data on that variety. But then you back up and you say, well, but, you know, I'm a plant breeder. This is like heaven for a plant breeder. So we dig up those plants. Okay, and this is where our breeding program gets really complicated because we can't just transplant them over to another nursery in Wisconsin. They won't produce seed in Wisconsin at all. They're way, way too late in flowering. So we have to go down to Illinois to plant all of our seed production blocks, all of our crossing blocks, and all of that. So we take plants down to Illinois, and we've been doing that for about 10 years, and then we get seed production on them to intercross and advance to the next generation. And so our breeding program is very, very heavily complicated by the environment. We do field trials in these northern states, hardiness zones 3 and 4 and 5, and then we do seed production in Illinois. I've had two very, very good colleagues in Illinois that have been very, very gracious to help me, D.K. Lee and John Sedbrook at Illinois State University, D.K. Lee at the University of Illinois. And so we do all of our seed production down there. And it's just, you know, it's not easy, but it's the reality. It's what you do. So upland and lowland hybrids were the first way to start figuring out how to get this late flowering trait into germplasm that would survive these northern climates. The upland parent would provide winter hardiness. The lowland parent would provide the late flowering and the high yield. Ken Vogel was the first one to do this at USDA in Lincoln, Nebraska. And the idea is to make the cross, grow thousands of progeny, evaluate the progeny for flowering time, yield, and survivorship, intercross the best progeny, and repeat this process for another generation or two. The result of his effort was the first true biomass variety, Liberty Switchgrass. And we helped him evaluate Liberty Switchgrass and helped him develop the data for the release of that variety. And here you can see these are 4 environments that we evaluated. This is northern Illinois, DeKalb, Illinois, hardiness zone 5A. And then as you go to the right, we're going gradually farther north, Arlington, Marshfield, and Spooner, Wisconsin. This is way, way up in northwestern Wisconsin, so hardiness zone 3B. So you can see summer switchgrass. This is the upland type, very good yield all the way across. It's very well adapted. This is Canlow. This is the lowland type. It crashes and burns as you bring it into Wisconsin, so you can see the yield going down. But this is what happens with Liberty, and this is what's really exciting, to be able to combine the winter hardiness of summer with the late flowering of Liberty, and it's performed very well across all of these environments. So that's what led to the release of that variety. So that was the first step. Then the next step is we've said, basically, we want to develop a true lowland type. And so our goal then is really to breed a true lowland type with as late flowering as we can. And so we're doing this on a much larger scale. These are crossing blocks here, where we have a number of crossing blocks. We use maize as a pollen barrier, and as I said, we're doing most of this in Illinois. And so this is the first northern lowland type that we've developed compared to a northern upland type. You can see we have an increase in yield regardless of the environment. This is Arlington and Marshfield, Wisconsin, and so the yields actually look pretty good. So as, in terms of proof of concept, it looks like it's starting to work fairly well. So if you go back in the literature, though, and you think a little bit about what's going on here and what the mechanisms are and what it is we've done, this is a plot of the biomass yield advantage of the lowland type. So positive values would indicate that the lowland has higher yield than the upland ecotype, whereas negative values indicates that the upland type is higher in yield. And so it's plotted against mean minimum winter temperature. So as you go from the right-hand side, we're in Texas, you go to the left-hand side, we're in Wisconsin and Minnesota, you can see that the lowlands crash and burn. They're below that line. And what we've done by breeding is we've changed that relationship. And this is really pretty cool, because you take a graph like this and you realize the power of plant breeding and the power of germplasm collection to be able to accomplish something like this. So it's really kind of nice to be able to look at something like that and say, wow, we've really done something very, very significant in terms of altering this relationship. So this is an overhead view of one of the trials, just to give you a little bit of an idea. You can pick out these lowland types. Right here is one, for example. This is a selection we've made from Oklahoma. Here's another one we've made from Mississippi. And you can see quite a bit of difference from those. It's really hard to see them from the ground because this grass is about 8 feet tall. But in this kind of a view, you can actually see some of the differences there. Here's another shot from overhead, showing three different varieties. This is the lowland type here in the middle, and it's about 8 feet tall. And this is a late flowering upland type. It's about 6 feet tall. This is an early flowering upland variety that's already senesced and lodged. Okay. So one of the questions we've had is, how in the world is this even possible? How is it possible that we can go into Mississippi and Alabama and Florida and collect this late flowering germplasm, bring it to Wisconsin, and we actually get a few survivors? So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I've gone back to the geological record. And since the upland-lowland split, genetic split, about a million years ago, there have been 10 to 12 major ice age events, depending on how you define an ice age. And you can see what I mean by that, because you can look at these graphs and you can say, well, okay, yeah, you know, it kind of depends on how you define that. But you can see the temperature and the ice sheet fluctuation, okay? And those represent the ice ages. And so what happens during one of these ice ages? Well, what happens is all of these ecosystems become compressed. Everything gets compressed down toward the Gulf of Mexico. You've got glaciers that are 2 miles thick, and so where we are right now is a completely different ecosystem. Where I come from is under ice. And so the prairie, savanna, and scrubland where switchgrass grows is compressed down into the Gulf of Mexico. You have upland and lowland types that are occurring together. They're intercrossing with each other. You have gene flow. And so switchgrass essentially acted as a hybrid swarm with upland-lowland gene flow. And we've been able to see this massive amount of diversity in many of these sites that we've collected and characterized throughout the southern United States. So many of these populations essentially contain tiny amounts of genetic material that's left over from these hybridizations with northern types. So in many ways, it's not surprising to see a small amount of genetic variability for cold tolerance, even in a population that comes from southern Alabama. And that's what we're seeing. So we've done some candidate gene discovery. I'm getting a little bit away from germplasm collection, but into germplasm evaluation now. We have something called a Northern Association Panel that's a collaboration with Jerry Cherney and Ed Buckler at Cornell University and USDA that consists of 60 switchgrass accessions. Most of them are from remnant sites, some upland, some lowland. And we had 10 individuals per accession. We characterized these genotypes using what we call an exome capture pipeline with about 300,000 SNP markers. And then Paul Grabowski did a genome-wide association analysis. And this gives you an idea of what the panel looked like. This is an overhead view of the association panel, and you can see there's a tremendous amount of diversity, phenotypic variation for both flowering and morphology. You see see the green and the blue colors, the upland and lowland types, and the real fuzzy ones are the early flowering types, and the ones that are less fuzzy are the late flowering types. And what we found, interestingly enough, is we did find one gene that was responsible for a 20-day difference in heading. And so these are two markers. This is one marker here, and this is another marker here. Both are very closely associated, apparently, with that gene. And that gene turns out, it looks like it's a flowering time analog. It's very closely associated with a flowering time gene in Brachypodium and in rice. And so it's kind of interesting to be able to find this already. We're doing, obviously, a lot more work in this area, but those are the first results we have to report so far. I've got one picture here to show you that this phenomena isn't unique to switchgrass. We're seeing it in big bluestem as well. This is the first big bluestem nursery that I put out a number of years ago, and you can probably pretty easily visualize the kinds of plants I'm selecting out of that nursery. Again, I'm interested in biomass yield. And this plant here in the middle, this picture was taken in late October, and this plant still had not flowered. It's got heads on it, but no anthers yet by the time we had killing frost. So that's the kind of material we're looking for, and we're doing the same thing in big bluestem as well. And this kind of led to one of the most interesting experiences I've ever had. And this was before we came up with colleagues in Illinois. We were trying to figure out where in the world we were going to do seed production of these super late flowering types. And I didn't know if Illinois was going to be far enough south. So I called my good friend and colleague, Charlie Brummer, and I said, "Charlie, can you do some seed production for us in Oklahoma?" And so we talked about it, and he said, "Yeah, sure, no problem." So he said, "We're coming up to Madison in August. We're going to come on the company jet, the Noble Foundation jet." And so we had it all arranged there. The last part of their meeting was on a Wednesday morning, and I went to the farm. I dug up all the plants I wanted to select. I bagged them all up, put them in the pickup, and I drove to the Madison airport to meet them before they're going to fly to the Noble Foundation. And this was so cool because I felt like I was breaking the law. I come up to the gate, and this is the commercial part of the airport. I come up to the gate, push the button, they let me in, they buzz me, and they said, "You know which plane?" I said, "Yeah, it's that plane right there." "Okay, go ahead." So here I am, I'm driving out of the tarmac in the pickup, I pull right up to the plane, I get out of the plane, and I'm loading these bags of plants onto the plane, and Charlie takes my picture. And I'm like, wow, I just feel like I'm breaking the law. That was so cool. So like I say, can you tell that I like my job? All right, so I want to acknowledge a whole bunch of people that have worked with me on this program. There's a lot more, but these are the ones that have really been the core group working on flowering time of switchgrass. And a few lessons and conclusions from this. There's a lot of hidden treasures in plant germplasm. I've mentioned switchgrass and big bluestem as only two small examples. And I got to tell you, I wasted 10 years thinking that this was just going to be another bad idea because I convinced myself that there was no way these southern populations would survive in the north. There's no way we would be able to pull winter-hardy plants out of these populations. I just didn't think it was going to be possible, and I just sat around for a while thinking that it wouldn't work until we finally tried it. So these prairie grasses contain more genetic variability than we can possibly visualize, which will probably aid in their resilience and stability in the face of climate change. So I want to acknowledge four people that have been very, very influential in my career. Daryl Miller was my mentor. There's probably a very small number of you that remember Daryl. My mentor at the University of Illinois, and I've worked with Edzard and Ken and Charlie over the years, and they've been very, very valued colleagues. And so I'm going to stop there, and if there's time, we'll take some questions. Tetraploid and octoploid material. Although it can be done with a lot of effort. It's just very difficult to do. But like I did mention, we've actually found two prairie sites where we think that we have very, very strong evidence that there's been gene flow. Initially, it came from the fact that there are just tetraploids and octoploids that are sympatric, growing together with each other, and that they're very closely related to each other. But then at both sites, we've actually found hexaploids, and so we think those hexaploids are acting as a bridge. We haven't found evidence of it, but I'm quite sure there's probably 2-end gametes in switchgrass. I mean, almost all grasses have 2-end gametes. And we also know that there's haploidy. We have actually discovered haploidy in our lab, and Christian Tobias has done the same thing in Albany, California. So you put all that together, and I think there's been some gene exchange, but it's very rare between ploidies. So essentially, we look at octoploid and tetraploid as two separate breeding programs for the most part. Farm of spreading the meadow fescue around over that 10-year period, was it due to spreading the endophyte rather than spreading the plant or the host itself? It's possible, might be a combination of the two. I tend to think that it's the plant itself, because what happens is he purposely allowed the hay to ripen so that the seed was ripe, and the seed would go into the guts, and we know that seed passes through the guts and comes out in the manure. That's why I had that little picture of the manure path with the seedling, because we know they'll germinate that way. So to me, one of the questions is, did the endophyte help it? Not necessarily was that the reason, but did the endophyte help that plant to get established? And we don't know the answer to that. That's one of the things we hope to try to figure out as we're trying to sort through some of these issues of what role the endophyte plays in fitness of these plants. But that's a good question. Nodding her head. Yeah, that, I'm glad to see that. Yes. Question here.
You mentioned that you cultivar.
Yep.
By crossing the upper land and lower land.
Yes.
Later on, you mentioned about the other, the genes or homologs. Do you think, just faithfully, if you have done research, how many genes will change to have that unique foundation to that flower length?
Question, isn't it? that's the question that we're trying to answer right now. So the question is, in terms of, probably your question really applies not only to the hybrid, Liberty, the hybrid between the upland and lowland type, but it also applies to our northern lowland types as well. How many genome regions are we talking about? How many genome regions are really influencing flowering time? And what is it we've really been selecting for when we do this? And to be honest, I have no idea. We're right in the middle of that work right now. Trying to see how many genes we can find, how many genomic regions we can find that influence flowering time, as well as cold tolerance. So we've got projects on both of those traits right now, trying to figure out what's going on. But right now, we just have the one site, the FT gene. Yes? I haven't actually speculated about that. I see what you're saying. Yeah, each individual plant might have a different genomic region, and that's possible. There could be one genomic region that's giving that late flowering and giving us that cold tolerance. But to be honest, I haven't really speculated on that yet. I've been very reticent to do that myself until I get more molecular data, until we get a little bit farther along and start seeing what's going on. So. Yeah. Ken?
So, in terms of your flowering, have you looked at any of these lowland types, in a greenhouse where you freeze protected them? How far will you go?
we haven't done that yet, but we're going to do that for the first time this winter. So we actually have a mapping population, and this is one of the areas where we're hoping to get some answers to the questions that you're raising. We have a mapping population that between two lowland grandparents and two upland grandparents, and that population is going into that freezing test just like you're describing this winter. Those plants are undergoing hardening right now, and they're getting ready in December. At least we have the cold rooms reserved for December. We don't know if the outdoors is going to be cold enough by that time, but we're hoping to get hardening by that time, and then they're going to go into a series of six different freezing temperatures. Every genotype goes in at every temperature, so we get an idea of the LT50, the temperature to kill 50% of the plants. So right now what we have is we have plants that will, everything that we have collected will flower at some point. But I haven't been to Cuba yet, and I haven't been to southern Mexico yet, and I know there's switchgrass down there. I think we just need to go farther and farther south to get that later flowering. Or we need to be able to say, you know, hey, we've got one lowland plant here that's late because of this gene, another lowland plant that's late because of a different gene, and then cross those two with each other. So there's probably going to be a number of different strategies if I'm around long enough to be able to implement them, but that's kind of the idea. We're not there yet. Right now we're to the point where even plants from the right along the Gulf Coast, they will flower in late October if we don't get a killing frost by that time. Now, Big Blue Stem is different. I've got Big Blue Stem plants that will never flower in southern Wisconsin. We're seeing inflorescences in almost everything before, you know, probably about the end of September. It'd be the latest, two weeks maybe. If you say from middle of September,
yeah. September 21st.
Yeah. Well, for you it is, but not for me. Not in Wisconsin. Well, I can't. I mean, we don't have 12-hour daylights everywhere on September 21st. Did we?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Okay. All right.
Yours. Yeah. You get shorter quicker than we do.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Good point. Yes.
I was intrigued by the map of the oak park forest.
Yep.
Savannah.
I'm
thinking about the Middle East where you have similar.
We're not seeing that kind of variation, but that could just be because we're not necessarily looking for it yet. We're actually doing some of those kind of measurements now in terms of grain size or seed size, but I don't have the data yet, so I don't really have any kind of an idea on the answer to that yet. Our focus has really been on the forage so far, the forage traits. Pardon? We see that. We do see that. Yeah, we see that kind of activity with ants. Yeah, in some of these ecosystems. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.